The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society, celebrating more than a half century of promoting awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org. This podcast is brought to you through the generous financial support of the Tongyang Group. In the areas of financial services and manufacturing, the companies of the Tongyang Group harness the passion and creativity of 12,000 employees worldwide to better serve their clients. The Tongyang Group, a global partner for Korean business.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Korea Society and welcome to Studio Korea. We hope that you all have Olympic fever. It's been a wonderful weekend with the opening of the Sochi Games, the magnificent opening ceremonies, and a really interesting few days of sport. And we have an exciting time ahead. We here at the Korea Society are delighted to also be talking today about the Pyeongchang Games. And as far as we've been able to tell, outside of Sochi or Korea, this is the other event that is taking place to begin to celebrate that four-year process, and that of course has been a process already well underway since Pyeongchang captured the bid. To help us understand the dynamic of politics and sport, we are graced today to have Victor Cha from Washington, D.C. Unfortunately, the threat of bad weather has kept Victor in Washington, but we're very happy that he has taken the time, and he is joining us from the Center for Strategic and International Studies, where he is the Korea Chair. Victor is also a very distinguished professor at Georgetown University and the director of Asian Studies there. And he is the author of this book, Beyond the Final Score, The Politics of Sport in Asia, which he wrote around the time of the Beijing Games, but which does touch on Sochi and the bid process and explain some themes that we'll draw out here today. We hope on your way in that you've had a chance to see some of the Olympic memorabilia in the case, as well as the original 1988 sport posters. If not, please join us toward the end and have a good look. Victor, welcome. We're delighted to have you here today. And how have you enjoyed the kickoff to Sochi?
Oh, hi, Steve. They've been fantastic. I think the games have been wonderful so far. And I apologize for not being with you all there today. You were right. The threat of bad weather scared me off. In part because I had to be back in D.C. tonight for something, and I couldn't afford to be stranded in Penn Station this evening. But I'm looking forward to a good discussion with you. And I see that there's a USA jacket where I guess I was supposed to sit. That's a nice substitute.
There you go. And that's actually one of the original team jackets from the Nagano Games. We have a very distinguished audience here today of people from across the corporate community, the United Nations community, NGOs, and universities. They are enjoying both a bit of sandwich as well as Choi Bani, who are official sponsors of Team USA. That plug is for Senator Schumer, who has been a big defender of one of New York State's products. And we also have Coca-Cola, one of the chief sponsors. We are in the Samsung conference room. And of course, Samsung is one of the major global partners of the Olympics. Victor, if we could begin and talk a little bit about maybe an update of your book, how you have seen these ideas unravel. I've thought quite a bit about your book during the start of the Sochi Games, in particular your notions of how sports can lead to breakthroughs or breakdowns, the ideas related to national images, and the ideas in terms of fermenting change. And I'm wondering if we could touch on some of those in discussion in relationship to Sochi, and then we'll get to Pyeongchang in a bit.
Sure, Steve, I'd be happy to do it. As you know, this is an area of research for me that was fairly new when I undertook it. I came out of the White House in 2007 and really didn't have the inclination to write about what I had just been working on. And so I needed a bit of a break. And so in that sense, this foray into looking at sports and politics was something that I always wanted to do. I had a folder of stuff tucked away in my file cabinet of things that I had collected over the years, and I knew I always wanted to write a book about this. So I figured that was the best time to do it with the Beijing Games coming up. And it's been a very fun part of broadening my scholarship. I end up going to conferences in different parts of the world where people have no idea that I'm a Korea expert. They think of me as someone who does sports and politics. I'm on the editorial board now of some of the major journals on the history of sport and politics. So it's quite a lot of fun, particularly around times like this when we see an Olympics taking place, and a very historic one. I guess the first thing I would say is the point that you mentioned, which is that, you know, whenever you have an Olympics like this, it's for any nation and city that hosts it, it really is a benchmark of national aspiration, national identity. I remember when the Russians got the Olympics, you know, you learn about it about 7 years earlier when they got the bid for the Olympics, everybody was calling out about how Russia is back. I think Putin even said, Russia is back. And so these games become a very important way to frame a country's development, a particular stage in its development. We know the Beijing Games in 2008 was supposed to be the coming out party, the culmination of three decades of modernization going back to Deng Xiaoping. So, you know, I think for every country, there are huge stakes in terms of their national identity. And for Russia, too, I think that's certainly been the case. I mean, the image and the photos we saw last night of Vladimir Putin with the Russian ice skating team after they won a medal over the weekend, you know, again, just shows sort of this notion of it's hard for us to separate sport from nationalism, national identity. When these athletes are out there, even though they're playing for themselves, they wear the colors of the nation and they personify a country's pride.
You know, interesting, Victor, because on the one hand, I think we'd all be in agreement that this first weekend has really shown Russia proud, certainly with the opening ceremonies, a focus on Russian arts and culture, its very distinguished history, certainly the pride of its athletes and the enjoyment of those athletes from around the globe in Russia now. But as you also mentioned in your book, stuff happens. The politics that surround the Olympics can sometimes become overwhelming. And there have been a lot of concerns raised. One, certainly political liberalization and civil liberties, the releases of political prisoners before, the tour by the Banned Pussy Riot in the United States, which has received a lot of attention here in New York City. Some of the athlete experiences that maybe have been a little more challenging in terms of transportation, the concern about terrorism and the safety issue, and concerns about infrastructure development, corruption, and the cost of the games, which are generally guesstimated at about $50 billion, a wildly large sum. So it seems a very complex take and set of issues, and I'm wondering if this early in the games you've had sort of an effort at kind of balancing that out, and if you have thoughts for us on that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, sort of a couple of things come to mind, Steve, with your question and our the discussion thus far. The first is, you know, countries like Russia, obviously, that host these games, they want them to be a success, right? They want them to be a huge success. Again, an important symbol of national identity. And so there are several things that have to happen, as we've seen in past Olympics, in order for these things to be successful. The first is performance, right? And what I mean by performance is the hosting country, Russia, their athletes have to do well. I mean, they have to do well in these games. You can't be the host and talk about this as being a big moment for Russia if the performance is not up to par. So for the hosting nation, there's even more pressure, I think, on the athletes to perform than there are on those who are visiting the country to compete for their national Olympic team. And so that remains to be seen. But obviously, when it comes to winter sports, Russia has always been quite strong. They've been one of the top four three or four medal winners historically since the Winter Games started in 1924. So I imagine that they will do quite well in these Olympics in terms of performance. The second thing that's often focused on in the run-up to the Games is logistics. When countries and cities bid for the Olympics, there's an elaborate process where one of the main things that they need to convince the IOC of is the fact that their city, their chosen bid city, is capable of hosting the world for 2 weeks when everybody convenes for a game. So, you know, carrying off the Olympics is a very important part of this whole idea of it being a success. And I think there have been clear examples of logistics successes. Beijing was considered one of them afterwards, Sydney in 2000. There are also ones that have been considered logistics, let's put it politely, not so successful. And Atlanta was one of those examples. So this is also a very important part of it, and we see it certainly in the media coverage in the run-up to every Games. You know, with every Olympics, whether it's Sochi or Beijing or London or LA in 1984, whatever it is, there's always this question about whether they will be ready. You know, will the paint be dry by the time the athletes arrive? You know, will the hotels be finished? And we saw initially talk about how journalists were arriving late at night and checking into hotel rooms where other people had already been checked in. We saw those very funny pictures of the dual toilets. You know, all these sorts of things, I think, are part of the Olympics. And so in that sense, Sochi, I don't think, is that different from what we've seen in past Olympics. And then the third element has to do with the politics. And here, I think particularly when we talk about regimes like Russia or China, when they host these games, again, they want these to be successful. They want these to be a sign of national strength, national pride. But at the same time, when they take on the Olympics, they are for 7 years in the run-up to the Games placed under an intense magnifying glass where everybody can look at all the flaws and every group that has a bone to pick with the government or with the policies of the government come out in droves to use the Olympic magnifying glass as a way to try to show that these are the flaws in the regime and try to put pressure on these countries. We certainly saw this in the run-up to the Beijing Olympics, where there was tremendous pressure placed on the regime, whether it was in terms of policies in Africa, human rights policies, isolation and jailing of human rights activists in the country, whether it was clean air. On almost every possible angle, the Beijing Olympic Organizing Committee and the government was being attacked in almost every single direction. And that was really the narrative coming up to the Games. What's interesting, I think, about Sochi is there's been really one issue that has dominated in terms of the politics in the run-up to the Games, and that has been terrorism. That has been predominantly the issue. Early on, there was clearly concerns about discrimination against LGBT in the run-up to the Games, but the dominant narrative in the run-up has been terrorism. And that, on the one hand, is very important because certainly big events like this, these mega sporting events, have been soft targets for terrorists. They're ideal targets for terrorists. And so everybody must be prepared for that. That's absolutely necessary. On the other hand, when you step back at it and look at it from the politics of Olympics more broadly, it's unusual that only one issue has dominated because it tends to close out all or push out of the media's attention all the other issues. And that has certainly been the case in the run-up to these games where terrorism has been the primary issue. And in a sense, Putin and the Russian government have kind of gotten away with avoiding the criticism that most regimes come up against in the run-up to the games.
Mm-hmm. Victor, if I can ask you a little bit of inside baseball. Most of us know that you were senior director for Asia at the National Security Council under George W. Bush. President Bush made the decision to go to Beijing. President Obama made the decision not to go to Sochi. How do you evaluate that?
I think every president makes their own decision, like every world leader makes their own decision. Beijing was, I think, a very unique and important games. It was only the third time that the Olympics had come to Asia, you know, since 1896. Prior to that, the last time was Seoul in 1988, and then prior to that, Tokyo in 1964. It was the first time the Olympic movement was coming to the largest population in the world in China. And so I think there are lots of reasons. And in President Bush's case, you know, it was truly and only about the sport. I mean, he wanted to go to root for U.S. athletes. He is a big sports fan himself. And in that sense, he made a sort of sports purist decision. I mean, he didn't think about the politics. He decided to go. And in that sense, I think he gave a lot of cover for other leaders to go as well, because he set the tone by saying, I'm just going to root for U.S. athletes and for the Olympic movement, not for any other purpose. I don't know the reasoning behind President Obama's decision not to go. It's entirely his choice. But in the end, I think when these leaders go, they go because they see it largely as being for the pure sport of it, and they try to keep the politics outside of their decision.
Mm-hmm. You know, since you've mentioned the history, let's look a little bit in particular, since we're here at the Korea Society, at the 1988 Games, which you write about extensively and very eloquently in the book. In terms of Seoul's coming out, a lot of these same issues of accountability, and we need to remember back that we were dealing at the time, first with the regime of Park Chung-hee, and then the administration of Chun Doo-hwan. And that had a very dramatic effect relative to the democratization process, in particular as we got closer to the games in 1987, and there were demands for accountability and recognition of the democratization movement. Could you guide us through a bit of that history in relationship to these broader themes?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, again, one of the themes in the book is this notion of how sport can be an agent for change. It was certainly a very helpful variable, an agent for change in transforming U.S.-China relations in the early 1970s. But it can also be an agent for change in places like South Africa, where the boycott of rugby was actually a very important factor in South African views with regard to apartheid. And in some cases, it can foster domestic political change, and I think that was certainly the case in South Korea. I mean, it's probably one of the most important cases that we've seen where a sporting event, played actually a quite important role in South Korea's democratization process. It's not that somehow the Olympics created democratization, but I think, again, it goes back to this notion of national identity. The Chun Doo-hwan regime saw the Olympics as a very important part of South Korea's modernization. It was South Korea's coming out party. Again, it would have been only the second time the Olympics were hosted in an Asian country. And so it had a great deal of meaning for the nation and for its development. And the fact that all of these democratization protests were happening a little over a year prior to the Olympics being staged in Seoul created a lot of concern among international media, obviously human rights groups and democratization activists, but also the media and others, about whether it would be possible actually to host the games in Seoul if these sorts of protests and police and martial law were all happening in the main thoroughfares of the city. So there was actually quite a great deal of concern. I believe it was NBC was not delayed sort of setting up their broadcast studios in Seoul because of this. There was some talk in the IOC about alternate sites if the games could not be held in Korea. I think the cover stories of magazines like Time and Newsweek were asking, you know, will this be the first Olympics held behind barbed wire? So there were lots of concerns, and I think for someone like Chun Doo-hwan, and particularly No Tae-woo, who played an instrumental role in actually bringing the Olympics to Seoul, the last thing they wanted to see was some sort of crisis in which they would lose the games. And so, you know, it wasn't the only reason why democratization happened in 1987, but it played a very important part. And if you had to sort of pick one thing where it really mattered, I would say the one place where it really mattered was in the spring of 87, when they had those democratization protests. The Chun regime did contemplate implementing martial law. And I think the optic of that in the run-up to the games would have been disastrous, absolutely disastrous. And so I think for both Chun and No Tae-woo, they internalized how important the games were to Seoul. And that probably played some role in their decision not to implement martial law and eventually to accede to the demands of the protests for a direct presidential election.
Mm-hmm. And interesting that from the economic development perspective, Park Chung-hee had basically looked at Tokyo in 1964 and Japan's coming out and basically said, although you describe a difference between sort of Japan's reemergence after World War II and its image and Korea's coming out in terms of showing itself as more of a modern nation on the global stage. You also point out that No Tae-woo had been sports minister as well as in charge of the Olympic Committee, and that that had a tremendous impact, and that when he made his declaration on June 29th, he actually invoked the Olympics several times to talk about the context of democratization and all eyes of the world watching.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I mean, his personal experience in sort of securing the games for Seoul, I think, really internalized for him how important the Olympics were. You know, when the IOC made the decision to give the games to Seoul, this was like in 1981, I think. Mm-hmm. It was a very controversial decision at the time. I mean, this was only, you know, this was only a few months after the Gwangju uprising, the massacre there. So it was an extremely controversial decision. And at the time, they were giving the Olympics. The IOC decided to give the Olympics to a country that was not a democracy. I mean, Korea was not a democracy at the time. By the time the games were held, of course, it was. At the time that the games were given to Seoul, it was not. And that was a very unusual decision. I think it was one that, you know, Juan Antonio Samaranch, the head of the IOC, played a very important role in. You know, in 2000, China was Beijing was one of the final candidate cities for the 2000 Olympics. And in the end, the IOC just could not give the games to Beijing, much as they wanted to bring the games to China. They just could not give it to Beijing because of the aftermath of Tiananmen Square. And in the end, Sydney got those games. So it was, you know, a very important moment for No Tae-woo, and I think, academics could argue this, but one could wonder that if it hadn't been No Tae-woo, who was the favored candidate for the ruling party, Chun's party, to run in that 1987 election, you know, who knows what would have happened.
Yeah. You also mentioned that the Nordpolitik, the northern policy, was very much connected because of the fact that the Soviet Union participated in the 1988 Games. You also mentioned that the Asian Games played an important role, both in terms of the Seoul Games in 86 and China's participation, and Korea's participation in the 1990 China-based Asian Games, and that allowed for normalization, or it certainly helped a bit, as 1990, 91, 92 came along, and it was time for transitions and opening up and diplomatic normalization.
Yeah, I think the Koreans, have been quite successful at using sports diplomacy as an effective tool to open and improve relations with countries. I think the Koreans, you could do a case study of how well the Koreans used unconventional diplomacy, in this case sports diplomacy, to help break down Cold War barriers in the early 1990s, as you said, both with China and with the Soviet Union. We're actually starting a project at CSIS on Korea as in terms of middle power diplomacy, and we're looking at different case areas. We're looking at global health and civil nuclear energy, but one of the areas that we're looking at is also sports diplomacy, because Korea has been very successful at that, as you just mentioned. I mean, I think what people forget was when Seoul hosted the Olympics in 88, this was following two successive Olympics that had been boycotted, the 1984 Games boycotted by Soviets, and then the 1980 Moscow Olympics boycotted by the United States. So there was real concern at the time that the Olympic movement was under threat, that it was going to be destroyed by the politics of the Cold War. And so, again, very controversial decision to give the Games not only to a non-democracy, but to a frontline state in the Cold War, you know, a U.S. ally that was a frontline nation in the Cold War. And the Koreans knew it. They knew that there was a lot of pressure on them to ensure maximum participation in the Games. And so they worked very hard at it, particularly with the Soviets, in terms of starting to work on their officials that came to the Los Angeles Games. They didn't have athletes who came to the Games because of the boycott, but there were Olympic officials from the Soviet Union that did attend the Los Angeles Games. And, you know, from that point on, the Koreans worked very hard on bringing the Soviets. They invited the Bolshoi Ballet to come to Seoul. They invited the Moscow Philharmonic. You know, they used all sorts of means and measures to try to create political goodwill so that the Soviets would participate. And perhaps most importantly in that respect was this notion of Nordpolitik, as you mentioned, Northern policy, where the South Koreans essentially said, look, we're going to have a pragmatic relations with a lot of these countries in Eastern Europe based on sort of economic complementarities and put the politics aside. And so they were very successful at starting relations with countries in Eastern Europe, and in that way put not so subtle pressure on the Soviet Union to also start to participate in Korea's northern diplomacy.
Mm-hmm. Let's jump ahead then to Pyeongchang. In the book, you talk about it in terms of the bid. Pyeongchang actually was up against Sochi, as was Salzburg. Sochi, to the surprise of some, was a victor for the reasons that you've outlined in terms of the reemergence and the emphasis that Putin placed on that. But Sochi now will be handing off the torch in 2 weeks' time to Pyeongchang. And Pyeongchang was successful in its third bid. And we're absolutely delighted here at the Korea Society to begin 4 years of programming off and on that will touch on the lead up to the Olympic Games. And I'm interested to know your thoughts. 4 years out, there was a celebration today in Sochi in Pyeongchang House, which is set up for that handoff, and certainly in Korea as well, some notation today of what will be 4 years, the opening on February 9th of those games, opened while Park Geun-hye is president, and I believe the closing ceremonies come after the next president has been inaugurated.
First of all, Steve, I want to thank you for reading my book again so carefully over the weekend. I recall more of the facts in the book than I can possibly recall. Sure. I mean, I think, you know, one thing you got to give the Koreans credit for is if they sort of put their mind to something, they're going to achieve it regardless of how many times they fail. And that was certainly the case with the bid for the Pyeongchang and the Winter Games. you know, I think this was a long time coming. A couple of things come to mind. First is, again, South Korean persistence. Each time that they bid for these games, they improved their technical report to ensure that the IOC would grade it very positively. And each, you know, I think as I talked about in the book, I thought there was a tactical mistake made in the last round when the South Korean government at the time tied the winning of the Pyeongchang Games. The IOC, you know, if the IOC would give the Pyeongchang Games to Korea, that it, how it would help unification and inter-Korean relations. And I think that was probably a tactical mistake because the IOC doesn't like to be put in a position where they are somehow being told whether they do or don't assign the Olympics to a particular city is going to determine the level of political reconciliation that takes place with North Korea. So that was probably not a good move, and may have been one of the reasons why they didn't win the bid the last time. Very clearly, 2018, they are going to be the city. Again, I think it's a fantastic thing for the Olympic movement, the Winter Olympics, which have not been to any other country in Asia except Japan. So this will be the first time that it'll be outside of Japan. It'll be Korea. You can bet your bottom dollar at some point it will be in China, because the IOC wants to expand the reach of the Olympics outside of traditional areas like North America, Oceania for the Summer Games, and Europe. So you'll expect to see more Olympics in parts of Asia, North Asia, as well as Southeast Asia. And we'll also expect to see more in South America, I think, as well. Rio, obviously, will be the next place in terms of the Summer Games. I mean, I think for it being in Pyeongchang, I think undeniably there will be some element of Korea and its political situation on the peninsula. Pyeongchang is the only province in Korea that has divided between the north and the south. And invariably, in the run-up to the games, there will be talk about fielding a joint team between the north and the south. Given that the south is hosting, there will be demands, I'm certain, from the north that they will want to host or co-host some of the games. I'm sure that's one of the reasons why Kim Jong-un built the ski resort. So I think we'll see all these sorts of things start to come up as we get closer to the games. But undeniably, a very important step for Korea in terms of the notion of global Korea, whether it's G20, Nuclear Security Summit, development assistance, the DAC countries, whatever it is, Korea has really sort of proven its mettle as a global player, and the Olympics is certainly going to be one of those things that validates that.
No, we thank you for that, because the idea of Korea as a host and as a hub is very much one here at the Korea Society that we hold dear and is a foundation of a lot of our programming. Well, Dr. Victor Cha, thank you for your gold medal performance, and we really appreciate your time. We usually converse with you about North Korea and hard security issues, so this has been a real treat for us, and we look forward to welcoming you back up here again. We hope you enjoy the rest of the Sochi Games, and we wish that to our entire audience here, and we look forward at that closing ceremony to see the handoff from Sochi to Pyeongchang, and what will no doubt be an exciting few years in anticipation of 2018. Victor, thank you so much for joining us today. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Victor Cha.
The opinions expressed in the preceding program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Korea Society, its staff, management, or sponsors. Thank you for listening to this Korea Society podcast. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Visit www.koreasociety.org for information about memberships and to learn more about all the programs available at the Korea Society.